Welcome to the WBGO Journal. I'm Doug Doyle. We continue our Voices of Wellness series as WBGO's Janice Kirkell takes a closer look at the battle over healthcare.
It's almost like death by a thousand cuts. Right now, we don't have the target, isn't really on the local health department, but it's public health in general.
I'll chat with Ngozi Nyawu, the award-winning playwright and director of Two River Theater's upcoming production of The Monsters.
My big brother was an MMA fighter, so this is very much a love letter to my big brother, Azuna Ayanwu, who used to be an MMA fighter.
WBGO's John Kalish has the inside story of the new movie, Blue Moon.
Kaplow worked on the Blue Moon screenplay over the course of 14 years. He completed the first draft in the summer of 2011.
And film critic Harlan Jacobson reviews Springsteen, Deliver Me From Nowhere. All this coming up today on the WBGO Journal. The government shutdown is now more than 3 weeks old. The battle is, of course, over healthcare, tax credits to reduce premiums, and proposed cuts to Medicaid, known here as New Jersey Family Care. Democrats also oppose spending cuts to government health agencies. WBGO's Janice Kirkell takes a look at what such cuts could mean for public health in the Garden State.
Experts say the proposed cuts to federal funding and to staff at the federal level will have profound effects on how health care is administered and to whom it is administered. Stephanie Silvera is a professor of public health at Montclair State.
This is going to cost New Jersey potentially billions in federal funding annually, and it's estimated that about 350,000 people may lose coverage entirely.
She says even if people don't lose coverage, they will feel the bite in other ways.
There's going to be higher out-of-pocket expenses for seniors. There's going to be cuts to services like home health care and home therapy.
As the state tries to save these services, she says that will place an additional burden on its budget.
There's a finite amount of money, and so it puts the New Jersey state government in the position of having to decide, who do you fund, right? We have schools that we still need to fund. There's infrastructure that still needs funding. And then there's healthcare. And so who's going to lose?
So far, there has been no mention of actual cuts to Medicare. But Silvera says if there are cuts to New Jersey Family Care, that will strain the resources of Medicare because there are a lot of dual enrollees. Seniors or people under 65 with disabilities who are on Medicaid and Medicare. She says evidence of the cuts is already showing up.
There have been cuts, and we're starting to see that, to public health, to community health centers, to, you know, changes in reimbursement rates. And I think that there are going to be some providers and services that may need to close facilities.
Silvera says even though people think of New Jersey as a small state that is not particularly rural, closure of facilities of various kinds may mean people's needs not being met.
I was at a meeting with public health leaders throughout New Jersey in public health settings and in these health departments who are really struggling. They have money right now, but that money is running out, and they're not able to hire new people when people leave the field or they move or they retire.
And the cut, she says, will likely be felt most severely in areas that can least afford it.
There have been cuts to services, for example, in Grants and Patterson for programs that work with children to address drug, alcohol, and smoking prevention programs.
Chris Helwig is the health officer for Hamilton Township near Trenton, just one of the more than 100 local health departments in New Jersey. His department provides a long list of public health services, nursing, a childhood health clinic, a sexually transmitted disease clinic, HIV testing, and investigation of communicable diseases. In addition, there is staff outreach for health education programs, a flu shot campaign, as well as inspection programs for everything from food to public pools, tanning salons, and animal shelters. Helwig says back in the spring, COVID-era funding was pulled back. Such funding was not limited to use during the pandemic. Letters said the grants, quote, did not meet the priorities of the current administration.
They got the letter and it's like, your grant is terminated, and this means, you know, we have staff that work on that are paid directly off of these grants. We're providing programs, there was construction happening. It caused chaos, and basically everything that we were doing had to stop.
He says some of the money has been reinstated by court orders, but stressed that the situation is very precarious. The federal cuts, he says, are sometimes more about people than money.
There's just a lot of brain drain happening throughout the federal government, and then that kind of trickles down to the state level and their ability to, you know, to respond to instances, which then affects us at the local level.
This, he says, gets in the way when there are questions about programs. For instance, whether something can be added or whether a line of funding is meant to be used for a particular purpose.
It's almost like death by a thousand cuts. Right now, we don't have, the target isn't really on the local health department, but it's public health in general. And that's eventually going to put the strain right on the local health department to try to find the resources for, you know, to take care of our residents.
At the federal level, an analysis by ProPublica found that more than 20,000 workers, almost 20% of the Department of Health and Human Services workforce, has left or been pushed out. But even that analysis is an undercount. It doesn't include the hundreds or even thousands of workers who have received layoff notices but remain on administrative leave. For the WBGO Journal, I'm Janice Kirkell.
Janice Kirkell's feature is part of WBGO's Voices of Wellness series, made possible in part by a grant from the Horizon Fund for New Jersey. Two River Theater's upcoming show, The Monsters, has already won awards. The world premiere co-production of Two River Theater and the Manhattan Theater Club is written and directed by Ngozi Anyanwu and runs at Two River Theater's Marion Huber Theater from November 1st through November 23rd. And here to tell us all about it is the director and the writer of The Monsters, Ngozi Anyanwu. Great to see you.
Great to see you. Thanks for having me.
This is a story where Lil has been obsessed with fighting, and one fighter in particular, her older brother, Big, an aging but successful figure in the local mixed martial arts circuit. Does this come from some source of you being involved with mixed martial arts, Ngozi?
No, I am a lowly artiste. But my big brother was an MMA fighter. So this is very much a love letter to my big brother, Azuna Ayanwu, who used to be an MMA fighter and has won in the local Jersey, Philadelphia market in the CFFC.
Wow, that's fantastic. What has been his reaction to you writing this play?
I mean, he's excited. He's very much like, I don't want to know anything. I don't want any spoilers, you know, because, you know, I very much use people in my life as a springboard. So it's not an autobiography of him, you know, but I've always been very fascinated with when he got into it, how it really raised his self-esteem, how he really felt a better sense of self. And I was really fascinated by the people that he hung around with. They were such interesting characters. And they also had such big hearts. I think a lot of people have a misconception for fighters, right? They're strong bodied. They hit people for a living. They make people bloody. And I was very moved by, I think, how he found camaraderie in it and how really heart forward they were. So I really wanted to make something about that.
You've been so successful in just a short period of time. When was the first time that Ngozi said, I've written something that is pretty good?
I mean, I would say, like, this first play of mine was Good Grief. And I had written that. I went to school for acting. So I had written that my third year in grad school. And that was very much the affirmation of my classmates. I went to UCSD, California, to get my MFA in acting. But that program was great. They had playwriting majors. They had directing majors. They had design majors. So I was at the beginning of germinating at the idea of a play that was kind of autobiographical. And I had been around playwrights for a long time. At that point, I had lived in New York already, hustled as an actor, really fell in love with plays like 13 years before then. But I was like, am I going to try my hand at writing my own? And I maybe had 30 pages of what to me was gobbledygook. And I put that in front of my classmates who were playwriting majors, acting majors, and kind of put myself in front of the firing squad for them to be like, do I have something? Should I move on? You know? And their beautiful affirmation was like, no. Like, you keep doing it. So I just kind of fearlessly would call in my classmates every once in a while before, you know, and read a scene. And it was a very fragmented process. And my playwriting colleagues were like, lean into the fragmenting of that. And I just kind of leaned in and I basically stopped at 100 pages and was like, okay, let me hear it. I think I have a play. I don't know if it's any good. It feels good writing, but then you hear and you're like, oh, well, try again. And I had my classmates read the first draft of that play that is now an award-winning play. And I felt good about what I had put out there. Like I'd gotten good affirmation from teachers, from colleagues, from classmates. And I was like, all right, let me keep shopping this play around, kind of like an actor, like you shop yourself around an audition. Let me start submitting it to those things. So for me, it was just the act of finishing. I'd always try to write, but more like skits and scenes and monologues. I had never at that point had the discipline or the confidence enough to just decide to finish a thing. So for me, once I had gone from the beginning to the end, I was already like, I'm a success because it's so hard to finish. And then I couldn't have actually dreamed that I would actually have the career that I have now.
The Monsters. Mm. First of all, tell us about the selection of the name.
Sure. You know, for me growing up with my brother, you know, like he was always called like a beast, right? Because he's a big guy. And there's such an interesting misconception with that, right? You see a big guy, you either want to climb him or fight him, right? And so for me, the Monsters was really a play on the title. Because I think so many men, Black men especially, are looked at that way, essentially. And so this play was really looking at the tenderness, actually, and if we can sort of get past the title, you know, and how that's a mask, right? That's a facade. That's kind of all we see. And so I was like, let's just actually go for it. You think you're going to see this really ferocious play, and you are. Like, we're doing choreography right now, and they're like, hold on, how many laps? How many jump rope? How many jabs? How many crosses? we're putting them through it. So you are going to see this really fierce, relentless play, but it's actually a play on the word monster, right? And so like a monster has to protect itself, but actually there's a big heart under there and there's a big beating heart. And so for me, the term was like, it was really a play on what you're actually going to see, which is, yeah, you're going to see some very ferocious people, but you're actually going to see like the opposite, like and to get past your idea of what you think a monster is.
Yeah, that happens a lot of times, especially in sports where mm-hmm. we see somebody and we may be intimidated by the size of them. And then, what a big teddy bear.
That's right. Right? But I didn't want to call it the teddy bear. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, that's another play.
Yeah, I'd rather the Monsters than the teddy bear. You're right. That is a whole other movie and everything else. In right. Disney. But I do want to, since you talked about the work that's going on. How about the cast? Tell us about the cast.
Yeah, Oak and Anya, they're just second to none. Oak and I have been friends for such a long time. I'm a first generation Nigerian, so is he. We kind of came up in New York together. Oak is of Hamilton fame. I think some of you will recognize him. He was Hercules Mulligan in the original Broadway cast of Hamilton, and he's on this great show called Damascus on Tubi, and he was on the show Station 19, one of Shonda Rhimes' shows. And, you know, he's been such a brother to me sort of in this industry. And so when it was time to cast the play and I was commissioned early, I was like, when are you available? You know? And so when he came on, it was lovely and a dream. You know, he's kind of always been a brother of mine. And so, and he's a big guy, you know? And so I was like, I really didn't have anyone else in my mind but Oak. Mm. So lucky to have him. And then with Anya was just a younger actress that I've just kind of come around in this circuit as another actor. You meet people, you meet friends, you're intrigued by artists, but also, you know, Anya is a hulking 6 feet, you know? And so I was really interested in what it would be to have a man and a woman who are the same size as siblings. You know, I'm much smaller than my brother. My brother's 6 foot, 250, 260. I'm 5'4", you know, wow. But I'm also very strong and physical. And so I really was like, what would it also be to have the sister be as physically imposing, physically intimidating, but also Anya has this beautiful baby face, you know? She's the opposite of how she looks, you know? And so I really was like, for this vision of the show, what would it be to have these acting titans? So it's been really fantastic. So she workshopped one of the iterations of the play, she auditioned for us and came back around and went out over everybody and just really... and those two have been really just cementing their friendship and relationship throughout the process.
That's great. How exciting is it when you've written something, and finally you get the actors that you want to portray these roles, and you see it in rehearsal, and you go, oh yeah, this is working.
Yeah, it's everything. It's really fantastic. You know, as a writer, you really do have a vision for how it's supposed to go, right? And then you got to fall back and go, oh, but they're not puppets. They're full on people with their full on ideas of how they think your play is supposed to go, right? So it is a sort of beautiful wrestling match of like wrestling of ideas. But ultimately, I try to be the writer that lets them kind of go in and frustrate me a bit and go, I have more questions. Are you sure you did it? There's more that can be expanded. So, but it, I mean, ultimately, you know, we're 2.5 weeks in and it's been really great because, you know, it's an honor to have actors want to do your play, right? It's an honor to have people who are busy, right? They can be doing other things, decide to do your work and really torture themselves over it and argue with you over it. Like, that's actually a deep sign of respect. So very honored by them.
The world premiere co-production of Two River Theater and the Manhattan Theater Club. It is written and directed by my guest today, Ngozi Anyanwu. Ngozi, thank you so much. And we look forward to seeing the show.
Thank you, Douglas.
You can see my entire conversation with Ngozi Anyanwu on the WBGO YouTube channel. Blue Moon, a new movie about the lyricist Lorenz Hart, has just opened in theaters around the country. Hart was one half of the prolific musical theater songwriting team of Rodgers and Hart. The screenplay for Blue Moon was written by Robert Kaplow, who lives in Metuchen, New Jersey. As WBGO's John Kalish reports, this is the second movie made from Kaplow's work.
Kaplow taught high school English in Summit for 34 years, but was always working on something during his off hours. Over the years, he finished a play, 9 novels, and many hours of highly produced radio comedy. One of his novels, Me and Orson Welles, was turned into a movie starring Zac Efron as a New Jersey high school student who lands a role in an Orson Welles play. The movie was directed by Richard Linklater. After it was released in 2008, Kaplow and Linklater kept in touch.
Since me and Orson Welles, we just talk on the phone every couple of months, you know, about literature, film, or politics, whatever. And he said to me once, what are you working on, Robert? And I said, I'm trying to write this thing about Lorenz Hart. And he goes, you know, I'm really interested in Lorenz Hart. Could I read that?
Kaplow sent something he had written about Hart to Linklater.
It wasn't really even in screenplay form. It was just a long monologue, but everything in the movie was there.
Director Richard Linklater shared the monologue with actor Ethan Hawke, who portrays Lorenz Hart in Blue Moon.
We were both, this is a movie. This is the kind of movie we could make.
Kaplow had long been a fan of Rodgers and Hart. He collected their sheet music, wrote Richard Rodgers fan letters, and at the New York Public Library at Lincoln Center, listened to an interview Rodgers had done. Kaplow was struck that Rodgers' explanation for ending the partnership with Lorenz Hart after 24 years was cold and dismissive.
They admire each other and are completely exasperated by each other simultaneously. That seemed electric to me and worth dramatizing.
Kaplow's screenplay for Blue Moon sets the drama in 1943. Rodgers is basking in the opening night raves of Oklahoma, his first collaboration with a new writing partner, Oscar Hammerstein II. The entire film takes place in one evening at Sardi's, the legendary theater district restaurant. In this scene, Hart is showering Rodgers with praise for a songwriting talent.
When I first heard you play your stuff, I knew you had it. I wasn't entirely convinced that I had it, but I heard something that afternoon. Originality, melody, grace. Come on, Larry, stop it.
Kaplow worked on the Blue Moon screenplay over the course of 14 years. He completed the first draft in the summer of 2011. In the ensuing years, Linklater and Hawke worked with Kaplow on revising the screenplay right up to and during the shoot last summer in Ireland, where Kaplow joined them on the set.
For so many years, it was a script, and I worked on it, and I tinkered with it. So many revisions, I couldn't even number them. I enjoyed working on it. I really enjoyed revising, and I thought it was getting better. I thought I was learning more about dramatic structure and comedy writing, but I wasn't 100% convinced it was going to exist in the world, you know.
Lorenz Hart struggled with alcoholism and depression. He was also grappling with his sexual identity. Though he was known as a gay man, Hart had a friendship with a female college student half his age, which figures prominently in the plot of Blue Moon.
Elizabeth!
Larry!
My irreplaceable Elizabeth.
I'm so happy to see you. Do you like the hair?
I love it. It's much better than the red.
I think so.
I mean, I like the red too, but this is much more otherworldly.
It is hard for us to look at people in pain.
Actor Ethan Hawke.
People in pain often behave badly, and so they're quote-unquote unlikable. But we have all been that person. We've all struggled with the green-headed monster of jealousy. We've all been worried our best days are behind us.
Robert Kaplow won't disclose what he's working on now, other than a monthly news journal called the Metuchen Times that covers his hometown. Blue Moon is now playing at theaters around the country. Actor Ethan Hawke's portrayal of Lorenz Hart has generated significant Oscar buzz. For the WBGO Journal, I'm John Kalish.
Blue moon, you saw me standing alone, without a dream in my heart, without a love of my own. Blue moon, you knew just what I was there for. You heard me saying a prayer for someone I really could care for.
Other stage tried to woo the new biopic Springsteen, Deliver Me From Nowhere, away. But in A Case of Life Imitating Art, Imitating Life, Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Bruce Springsteen would have none of that. And so director Scott Cooper and the producers got tax incentives from the New Jersey Film Office to film a story about a hometown hero in his home state. Our film critic Harlan Jacobson has more.
Director Scott Cooper had a hard task in making Springsteen Deliver Me From Nowhere. How to make a new rocker biopic that hits most of the usual notes and arrive at a film that at nearly 2 hours keeps you inside the frame. He does that. Though musician and chef stories are everywhere now, they've shoved other genre characters off screen to claim the fantasy life of young Americans about a life inside art. Over the last 20 years, there have been a lot of musical biopics, from Johnny Cash to Ray Charles, a couple of recent Dylan films, including A Complete Unknown, Elvis, Elton John, Aretha Franklin, even Don Shirley in Green Book, which won Best Picture in 2018. The genre is largely comforting, framing contemporary issues about class, race, and families, laced with self and other destruction. They're almost always built on an insistent artistic authenticity. It overcomes the opposition of the business, which is always backward-looking to what's already worked, and the developing opposition of the artist to him or herself. The lives of artists invite sympathy. They capture something about being human, and that describes Jersey Bruce to a T. Springsteen, Deliver Me From Nowhere, was shot last winter at the Frigid Stone Pony, the starting point for Bruce Springsteen in Asbury Park. Any story about Springsteen is by definition a Jersey story. Cooper starts pretty arty here in black and white in Freehold with Springsteen at about 10 in a sad home, which later haunts his choices and sense of self in the world. When not drinking and raging at his wife, played by Gabby Hoffman, Bruce's dad, Dutch, played by Stephen Graham, coming off his terrific turn as a dad in the 4-hour British streaming series Adolescence, takes his son for what's supposed to be a father-son outing to a Saturday matinee, only the film is Night of the Hunter, a murderous 1955 masterwork, also in black and white, from which Cooper ups the black humor ante by lifting the sequence of Robert Mitchum catching up to the terrified kids. Dad is clueless, and it's cinema's shorthand to link it to Springsteen's Nebraska album about his later adult depression after he breaks through in 1975 with Born to Run and Thunder Road, Hungry Heart, and his 1980 double album, The River. Springsteen shows up at a Nowhere Jersey car lot to reap the spoils, a hot Chevy Camaro Z28. "You deserve a car like this. I know who you are," says the salesman. "Well, that makes one of us," deadpans Jeremy Allen White, in character as a bewildered Bruce, setting up the central project for the film. Even a pre-Patty girlfriend, Faye, played empathically as your dream waitress in a diner by Odessa Young, can't hold the young Springsteen together. While Jeremy Allen White doesn't look entirely like Springsteen, he credibly sings him here. Cooper based his script on Warren Zane's Springsteen biography to underline just how thoroughly the Rockers' rocket ship left unfinished business behind in Jersey. No matter that Springsteen hits the genre's predictable skids, he pours that depression into his 1982 spirit-flattening album, Nebraska. 10 songs, rigged up on a home tape recorder in a cabin in Colts Neck. There's Nebraska, the title song about the Charlie Starkweather murder spree in 1957, Atlantic City about the mob swallowing the future in Jersey, plus 8 other Just Kill Me Now songs. And he gives his manager-producer, John Landau, played by Jeremy Strong, a non-negotiable agenda to take in to Walter Yetnikoff, then head of Columbia Records, who wanted another Hungry Heart. Instead, he got Nebraska with no face on the cover, no tour, and no publicity.
You want to know why I did what I did? Sir, I guess it's just a meanness in this world.
The two Jeremys work well together as symbiotic bros who share the vision and the vibe. But they each bring what they've perfected in their best-known vehicles elsewhere to the Springsteen story. Jeremy Allen White carries over from The Bear, his hit show on Hulu about a perfectionist chef in Chicago taking a working-class burger joint into haute cuisine territory. He has that chiseled stare found on Greco-Roman statues, the ones with blank eyes that are unfocused on the middle distance, as if some deep thought or feeling stalled out all forward motion. And as his business manager, John Landau, Jeremy Strong imports his most salient feature from Succession, where every one of the terrible Roy family, clones of the Murdoch clan, said you-know-what shriveling things to him on his way to stealing the empire, while he remained motionless, ignoring his hair being set on fire atop his frozen hangdog face, until he claimed the throne. Time will tell if these two Jeremys have other tricks, but so far, they both look born to run here. And I'm Harlan Jacobson.
Well, they blew up a chicken man in Philly last night. They blew up his house, too. I'm the boardwalk, they're getting ready for a hell of a fight. Gonna see what them racket boys can do. Well, now they're busting them in from. Commission's hanging on by the skin of its teeth. Well, everything dies, baby, that's a fact.
Thanks for listening to the WBGO Journal. I'm Doug Doyle. Join us next Saturday morning at 5:30 for another edition of the award-winning WBGO Journal. In the meantime, stay tuned to the world's greatest jazz and blues station, WBGO and WBGO.org. So I drew what I had from the Central Trust, and I bought two tickets on